Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser, Andrew Frankel, my co-host. This is episode 205. 205, Andrew.
205. Now, what should we be talking about today?
What could we possibly be talking about?
Possibly imagine.
We're not talking about old
not
French.
Even we're quite that cheap. Oh, I bet we do. I bet we end up talking about rubbish old French hatchbacks.
Well, in part because...
Which we love.
Well, we do. And we are joined by a guest this week.
Yes.
Paul Cowland. There he is on our screen.
Hello.
Paul, you must have had a 205, Peugeot 205 over the years.
Do you know what? This could be the shortest interview ever because I'm ashamed to say that I
never.
I haven't. But in my defence, before everybody turns off and switches off, I do have a Renault Clio Phase 1 16 valve and I've just bought the world's nicest Renault 5 TS, 1983 Renault 5 TS.
Oh. Ooh, okay.
Redeemed?
I used to have a 205.
Yes, you did.
Interview me.
Well,
I could bore for Britain on the subject.
I think I've done that enough over the years, Andrew. Well, Paul, so lots of people listening will know who you are, perhaps from your TV work on Salvage Hunters, classic cars, or maybe they've seen you on a stand talking to an audience at a car show or something. I think you're doing that just this weekend, weren't you?
I've just been doing that at the NEC, actually. We've had a lovely show, the Classic Car and Restoration Show at the NEC. And we were interviewing all sorts of wonderful luminaries, lots of fellow telly people, Ant Anstead. A chap called Richard Hammond came along.
Yep.
He's always a joy. Absolute delight to interview. Really lovely chap. Yeah, so 3 days of talking on the microphone. And on my first day off, here we are doing it again.
You get to do some
there you
more.
Go. Lucky old you.
You lucky thing. So for people who don't know who Paul Cowland is, well, let me just read your
that
Twitter.
Would be the vast majority.
Maybe.
To be fair.
Maybe. Let me just read your Twitter bio back to you. It goes along the lines of presenter, writer, producer, PR, car hoarder. So that suggests a little bit of everything. But you've been in the car world for a long time. You do a little bit of everything. Is that fair enough?
30 years, man and boy. Yeah. And all I've done from school is been the motor trade, buy cars, sell cars, write about them, photograph them, shoot them,
present.
It's all I know. I'm very much a jack of all trades, master of none. And it's very much a breadth of knowledge rather than a depth of knowledge. But yeah, the cars have been very, very kind to me for an
could
awful
we,
long time.
Could we just dig into, I just heard at the end of that, car hoarder. So that would suggest you've got a few of them.
One or two.
Are you one of those really tedious people who don't have got so many cars? I know a few people like this who genuinely don't actually know how many cars they own.
I'm ashamed to say, Andrew, I know the exact number of cars. Being an ambassador for a very well-known insurance company, Hagerty, I am required to know and insure correctly the number of cars I have. Yeah, so I do know that number, and it's a number that's probably more than a sane person should aim.
You are now going to tell us what that number is.
Today's number is 82.
82.
82 cars.
See, I had both those numbers in my head, just not in that order.
Yes.
For some reason, I was convinced you were going to say 20. You've got 82 cars.
82 cars. I'm not proud of it. It's not something that's happened by design. But imagine an old lady with cats. You know how the... Every street has a lovely old lady that she rescues every stray.
But even old ladies don't have 82 cats. They might have five or six.
That is a, that's
it's a bit out of hand. I admit I've got a problem. I know I've got a problem. I know, you know, 28 would be a very, very nice collection. 82 has got out of hand. I'd like to stress as well, some of them are really rubbish and quite cheap.
Good. Well, we want to talk about those.
No, we'll come on to those in a moment. I don't think I've ever come across someone with more than 82 cars. That is extraordinary. The point being that I suppose it reveals the truth about Paul Cowland, which is that he is an inveterate car enthusiast.
And you don't lie on your Twitter bio.
Yes. Well, that's true.
Well, no, I think hoarder is the only word, isn't it? I think collectors, I've met a lot of collectors, as I'm sure you guys have as well. And I think they have a real theme. They have style. You know, they're going down a road and they're truly...
Whereas
I, I'm the old lady with cats. Literally, I'm at an auction. It's the last lot of the day. I think, well, that's cool. And that, I mean, a great example, the Rover 75 limo. So I don't know if you know, the coach builder McNeely in Birmingham made 108-inch stretched Rover 75s for the British government ministers because they wanted them to be in a British car. The Rover 75 is obviously a 3-series competitor, so it's actually quite compact in the rear. And because they wanted the ministers to be in a Rover 75 and they didn't really fit, at some huge expense, they coach built 100 cars to be extended by 8 inches in the rear doors. So a really cool thing, and actually quite an elegant looking car. One of those was going through the auction at 5 o'clock at night for £1,250. Who would not bring that car home?
Yeah. Okay, so there we go. We need to manage expectations a little bit. You say 82 cars. How many of those are worth buttons?
Well, I think quite a large amount. Yeah. Quite a large amount. But there's that, definitely the Rover 75 limo, which is, it's actually in quite nice condition. I've got things like a Renault Espace Phase 1.5. I can't see that being worth an awful lot of money. Mm. But then you know what the car game is like. There's cars that I have bought for really tiny amounts of money. So I've got a really beautiful 1982 Mercedes 123 200, so the wrong engine, 4-speed manual, the wrong gearbox. But that archetypal little old boy car with 50,000 miles, full service history that I bought 15 years ago for $2,000.
Wow.
I had to pull the plastic off the back seats and I had to pull the plastic off the rear door cards because he'd never done it. But again, that car's not ever going to be worth a huge amount of money because of the drivetrain combination. But what a lovely car.
Yeah.
So do you rent an NCP to store your 82 cars?
I should. It's getting to that point. So I'm very lucky. We managed to buy the unit that I'm in now. So this is a garage. This is my executive plaza that you're all witnessing up here. And below this is a workshop. So there's about 31 cars in the workshop down there. I built a unit behind that has another 9 cars in. There's a secure yard and a car park that probably has about 20 cars in at the moment. There's about 9 at home. A very good friend of mine, David, thank you, David, has got about 8 or 9 in his garage. And then you've got cars all over the country in various states of undress, being painted, trimmed, restored, serviced. So it's fleet management, basically.
So do you sell cars at all? Or once you acquire them, do they just sort of... I mean, is it a sort of a flowing process with cars coming and cars going? Or is it a one-way street? Once you've got them, they're staying.
It should be a two-way street,
yeah.
Really, Andrew. That's what a sensible person would do, wouldn't it? You'd get one in, you get bored of it, and you get rid of it, and you get another. That's what clever people do. People with what I'm now learning is a problem. Just it's a funnel. It's
probably
with no
a clinically diagnosable problem.
So yeah, stuff keeps going in the top of the funnel, but nothing's coming out the bottom. Oh. We are now getting to the point where, using that same poor analogy, the funnel is now overflowing. We are running out of room, basically.
So are you going to sell some stuff?
No, he's aiming for 100.
I love my wife.
Are you aiming for 100? Is that the target here?
It would be good. I was the original target was 50 by 50. So I was 50 last year. So I was trying to get 50 cars by 50. Then we sort of smashed through that.
I was going to say.
And it's not my fault.
Well, and, you know, and 80 by 80 has already been and gone. Yeah. So
I don't know, lads. I should get rid of some, really. I think, you know, and I fully appreciate. So there is an Audi 100. I've got a beautiful Audi 100 CS, which was the run-out Audi 100, which is a really great car anyway. It's got the 5-pot engine. It's got the forged alloys that came on the Ur Quattro. Really cool car. And I've had it a long, long time. And I've found the gentleman that had the car previous to me, and he had the car for 15 years. So I think I will let that car go. Because I'm very aware. I don't want to ever become one of those collectors that looks after cars for so long and drives them so infrequently. You actually become the reason that the car suffers.
Yeah.
I think you're making a car better in your tenure, that's okay. But the second that you're not looking after it as well as somebody else could,
it's got to go. I completely agree. I mean, I've only ever owned a fraction of the cars you have, but so many of them, because of the job and because so often I have to be driving other stuff, its role in my life has become to make me feel guilty about having it. And the moment that happens, it's just got to go. It's got to go. Yeah. You have to have. So how do you, okay, how many of the 82 actually work? How many of them do you actually get to drive?
The vast majority actually work. Not all of them are taxed MOT'd at any one time, but the nice thing is they pretty much all start and run. The two that aren't at the moment, unsurprisingly, are both made in Blackpool, two TVRs. So we've got a TVR server.
This can't be a Chris Hanger. You've got 82 cars, and the only two which don't work are both TVRs. Are we saying that's a coincidence?
Yeah.
That sounds about right. So one's an AJP, one's a 4.5 AJP Red Rose. And that's, to be fair, that starts and runs beautifully. I could start it for you now. And
that's a Cerbera.
A bag of bolts. That's a Cerbera. That's lovely. Yeah. That's, when it works, that's a fantastic car. But it needs clutch and slave cylinders on that. And I've got a lovely short door S1, which to me is one of the great cars because it's the first of the Peter Wheeler era cars. And,
yeah.
and I he really defines TVR for me. He is to me what TVR is all about. So I wanted a Peter Wheeler car. And also, like many, many cars in my collection, the reason it's there is because it was very cheap.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, can we, I mean, we'll come on to the sort of glitzy stuff a bit later on, but I think people want to hear about the TAT.
TAT is what it's all about. It's really interesting. We've done these telly shows, and I've been lucky enough to be doing telly for about 13 years now. And we've done some really nice stuff. We did a restoration on the Lotus Esprit S1 that Lotus helped us with.
Mm.
And everybody loved that show. But the shows that people come up to me and say they enjoyed the most or got excited about, and interestingly, the viewing figures are the best for, is when you do inexpensive stuff. I think we all have, no matter how high up the tree you are, no matter how big a collector you are, no matter what you're into, if you can have fun with a car for 500 quid or £1,000, I don't care. They're the best cars, aren't they?
Well,
they are the best cars.
It becomes instantly relatable, doesn't it? Because, you know, most of the people watching that, instead of thinking, well, fine, that's interesting, but, you know, I'm never going to be... I mean, what's a fully restored S1 Esprit these days? It's a lot of money, isn't it?
We're at 70, 80 grand easily.
Yeah.
And whereas... I think we got 70-odd for hours. Yeah, but even the interior. So we went to the guy who is the son of the original trimmer for Lotus, and he does these beautiful recreations of that incredible orange and green tartan that they had in the period. Yeah. But that interior, and this was 4 years ago, so God knows what it is now, was £16,000.
Wow.
Okay, so give us an example on the programme. Give us an example of some of the TAT that's done really well.
Well, you know, the best one, and I love this story. So Rover P6, and I do love a Rover P6, and I think they're horrendously undervalued and underpriced at the moment. I think you get so much car for your money. And I love the fact they're just like a giant Meccano, aren't they? Because everything on a Rover P6 unbolts, just literally the roof, the doors, the wings, everything comes off to leave the skeleton underneath. And we bought a Rover on there for £2,000, spent a couple of grand on it, and sold it for £6,000. And genuinely, and this doesn't often happen in television, genuinely made a little bit of profit in the real world that you have to pay tax on. And that never happens in television. But a great story is my friend was working for eBay as a technician at the time. Now, the search term Rover P6 is probably, in an average evening on eBay, search term number 50,032.
Yeah.
It's not a search for thing. But whilst that show was going out, Rover P6 got in the top 10 of eBay search terms.
Of all eBay, not just the automotive bit?
Yeah, well, all of the eBay automotive, to be fair.
Okay.
But it went from 50,000 to in the top 10, just because people are watching it thinking, two grand for a Rover P6, I can afford that.
Was it a 1960s sort of 2 litre or a...
I think it was a 70, I think, 70 or 71, I think it was. I can't remember. It was a 2.2 anyway. And a little bit rough.
Twin car.
We made it a little bit less rough. And but great thing about those cars, we wanted to put a Webasto sunroof in just to kind of do something as a telly job. And of course, normally you've got to cut a hole and all that kind of stuff. But we actually found a scrap car with a mint roof in. And I don't know if you've ever worked on a P6. You literally just unbolt the whole roof and bolt the new roof back on. So fit the sunroof in 20 minutes.
So let's talk about your cars again. I didn't know you had so many cars, and we could clearly spend the entire episode and several more just talking about the stuff you've got parked up. But we'll try not to fill the entire podcast with just your stuff. But we need to get into it a little bit. What's the oldest car?
The oldest car?
Yeah.
The oldest car is a 1957 Volkswagen Beetle, which is an oval window, which to me is the prettiest of all the Beetles. And that car's currently undergoing a restoration. That's been in restoration for 10 years, that car now.
Can I ask, and I don't wish to sound sort of in any way pejorative here, but why did you buy a Beetle?
Beetles are my first love. If you said to me you can only ever have one car for the rest of your life, it would be
no.
Wow.
No. Andrew's not a fan.
What? You're the biggest Porsche fan I know. You can't have... This is genesis for many of the cars you love, Andrew. You can't have the 911 without the Beetle.
Mm. Okay. I think you'll find I can.
But what are more of the tap, please? People will want to know this. I mean, maybe it's unfair to call it tap, but I think you took delivery of a lovely old Renault 5 recently, didn't you?
Yeah, it's funny. That is very not tap. That's my very good friend Frederick, who keeps finding these amazing cars. So I've got a friend called Frederick who is Norwegian. He speaks every Scandinavian language, and he's retired now. And all he does with his day is he finds incredible rust-free, mint immaculate cars in Scandinavia, just toddles off of his trailer and brings them back. He has them for a little bit, he gets bored of them, and then he very kindly sells them to me. And he has just sold me the most beautiful 1983 Renault 5 TS.
Oh, I love a TS.
Come from the north of Sweden, and it's complete.
I love a TS.
What a car. With Dunlop alloys, so from the Renault Boutique Accessories catalogue of 1982.
So the TS, for people who aren't sad enough to know.
No idea, by the way.
No. Okay. Idea. Well, then most of them were TLs, you see. But this isn't a TL, it's a TS.
Of course.
It's the sporty one.
Wow.
But they did have a bit more power, didn't they?
Tiny bit more power. And they also have really beautiful seats. So they have sort of like the full race seats that you get in the Gordini. So they're very lovely. Bolsters and thinner architecture.
It was the one you wanted to have. It really was.
I'll send you a picture, chaps, and you can put it in the edit. And the alloys make it for me. These Dunlop alloys, I've never seen another Renault 5 on them.
I was always scooting round to the back of Renault 5 to see what the badge said. And if it said TS, I was always quite, okay, proper car.
So you're quite impressed with that.
Yeah.
But that's not that.
More impressed than I am with your Beetle.
Daily drive at the moment. And I'm just using, I don't know why I'm using it so much. I bought it as a winter hag. It's £200. Volvo V70 that got off a very lovely elderly neighbour of mine who managed to do the entire side down a bollard, which is why it was £200. Full history. And I've just put some conies and springs on it so it handles a little bit better and sorted the bushes out and done the alignment. I'm driving that car everywhere. And I came out of a lease car. I was leasing a Volvo S90, spending £300 a month, as we all do. And I think, well, that's stupid. Why are you doing that? Why are you spending money on a car that you're only renting? And I'm now dailying a £200 Volvo V70 as an experiment.
Yeah.
And it's doing everything that a brand new Volvo does, but for absolutely nothing. And of course, when you turn up in a slightly battered Volvo V70, to the people that matter, it's much more impressive.
Yeah. And if you get a big problem, you just throw it away.
Well, that's the thing. Or if it got stolen or caught fire or wasn't there in the morning. Or
it's disposable motoring.
It is.
But will it ultimately let you down at some point? Is that the problem with these very cheap older cars?
I don't think it will. I'm a huge fan. I think late 90s cars, I think everybody is missing a trick. There's a thing at the moment. Everybody should go out now and buy a late 90s car for £1,000, £2,000, because that car will do everything you want it to do. It will be reliable. The late 90s cars have one or two ECUs, no body control modules, no digital anything really, but they all have airbags.
We've talked about this before, haven't we? Peak cars.
There's a sweet spot, wasn't there?
Yeah, we've had this. What did we conclude? We say it was late 90s or early 2000s, but it's around then, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Cars were still relatively compact, comparatively light.
They hadn't got heavy,
yeah.
But they were way safer than the rubbish we grew up in the 70s and 80s. They were still decent to drive. You could still get three pedals in your foot well. You could still have decent state. Yeah.
Do you know?
I think it is the answer. I think we all need to go out, get one, and preserve one, and have that as your daily. And everyone can then. So what I did with that? So I lost my lease, got rid of that, bought the Volvo, and then with the money that I saved, I financed a Viper.
there we go. So we can talk about some of the more glitzy stuff in your collection now. Then, Dodge Viper. I had a model of one as a boy. Mine was a red one, GTS. I think Targa, like yours. That's what yours is, isn't it? And my little brother
Mine's an RT. Mine's the
original. Yeah. Yours is the really, well,
the silly one. It makes no sense.
Yeah.
Okay. My brother had a model of a blue one with the stripes, a coupe.
Yeah, that was the GTS.
And it's the other way around, right? Yeah. And when I found out that his was more powerful than mine, I was gutted.
But his model was more powerful than yours.
Yes, exactly. And Paul, I've been fascinated by Vipers ever since. How is it? What are they actually like to drive?
Do you know what? Surprisingly benign. Because you read all the horror stories, don't you? Think it's going to fire me into a ditch.
Well, that's why I assumed.
They're only 400 horsepower, which obviously these days there are Golfs with more power than that.
Yeah.
After
a remap. So they're not monstrously powerful. I mean, mine is on slightly elderly tyres, so I do have to be a little bit circumspect when I go out. I do need to save up for some new Michelins for that. But they're beautiful to drive. They're very compliant. The spring and damper rate's better than you think. I'm sure if you did something really, really silly with it, I mean, it has the power and the torque to fire you off, but I always drive mine quite
Have you ever driven it when it's raining?
Yes.
Have you ever tried to drive it fast? Very, very scary. I mean, okay, so I think the most scared I've ever been in a car without actually crashing it was trying to drive a Viper around Goodwood in the wet. There is actually some footage. I'm trying to do a piece to camera at the same time, and I had the most enormous moment in it, going through, what do they call it, No Name, the right-hander before you get into St. Mary's. I don't know whether the tyres they came on in period were, but this was back when they were new. But, I mean, those cars must be 30 years old now, aren't they?
Well, they are, yeah. So they're basically, mine's a 94, yes, exactly that. Yeah. No, exactly.
Yeah.
And mine's an interesting one because it's a European spec that I bought off a very good friend of mine who also kindly financed it for me, Kurt at Fast.
So it's a Chrysler?
Yeah, so it's a Chrysler. So it's the European spec one with the seatbelts in the sensible place and with the full width number plate on the back. So they're a super rare car. But yeah. I'm like you, really, Dan. I was obsessed with Vipers as a kid. And I just don't think many cars make it from concept so unmolested as that car did, because you can't believe that they did a concept with no real roof, no door handles, no security, no locks, no airbag, no ABS. For the time, a lot of power and a real purity of thought. So that car was meant to be the incarnation of a modern Cobra, and they absolutely nailed it. And they didn't do anything you'd expect a product team to make them do, like put handles on or locks on or things that cars normally have. They just didn't do any of it.
It's the kind of car that you just couldn't get right today.
No,
you couldn't do it today.
Couldn't do it. Not capture the spirit of it, could you?
Not like that. Not with that level of lack of spec. No. Mm.
That is a mighty
also,
car.
Also, I read a couple of books on that car because I was slightly obsessed with it before I bought it. Yeah. And apparently they did that entire car, including casting the engine, setting up the line, everything, the whole lot, for $49 million. Apparently, I've read that in two books now. $49.9 million was what it cost to create that car. That's nothing.
Blimey.
Really, can I tell my Viper story very quickly?
Please do.
So, I guess it was 1994. Steve Sutcliffe and I decided we were going to go and chase the Mille Miglia, and we wanted something to take, and there was a Viper knocking about. So we went down to Dartford, where Chrysler's imports came into at the time, to collect this thing, to drive it to Italy. And we realised very quickly we could either take our luggage or the roof, but not both. So we took our luggage. We then drove it to Italy through a rainstorm as fast as we could make it to get it to go. I won't talk about speeds now because I feel embarrassed about it. And we then chased it round the wettest Mille Miglia that there had ever been. I mean, what the interior of this car must have been like. And you had to, above a certain speed, you stayed dry. So you were very incentivized to drive it as fast as you possibly could. And yes, it sort of left a mark on me. And then when we got to the end of it, some idiot volunteered to drive it back. And we leapt at it and jumped on a plane, and I don't think I've driven a Viper since.
Wow. Yeah,
well, you're very welcome to come drive mine.
I'd love to.
I'll be hassling you about that quite soon, Paul. So you've got one or two other sort of flashy, higher-end cars, haven't you?
Basically, now I'm a gentleman of a certain age, I'm probably having my midlife crisis, to be fair. I'm just buying the cars that I promised myself when I was a little kid. So one of the cars I built 20 years ago, do you remember Knight Rider, the TV show?
Yeah, yeah.
I was obsessed with Knight Rider. So Knight Rider came out in 1982. I would have been 9 years old at the time. So I promised myself as a nine-year-old that when I was a big lad, I'd have one. So 20 years ago, I built a full Knight Rider replica, which I still have. Wow. That's a lot of fun. But then also cars that were on my bedroom wall.
Hang on. So then, what was the Knight Rider car? It was a Pontiac or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a Pontiac Trans Am. The one in the show was an 82.
Right.
Really nerdy now. Mine was a 1990, which was a Firebird Formula, which is kind of like almost the end of the run of what they call the F-body shape.
Okay.
So I had to backdate all mine and get all the correct bits, the nose cone, the flashy light on the front, the wheel cover.
Did it talk?
Mine doesn't, sadly. And also, I couldn't afford to do the interior because 20 years ago, to do an interior properly on a Knight Rider, it was 10 grand. And I think I built the whole car for six.
You can probably tell me what KIT stands for.
Knight Rider Industries something, isn't it?
2000.
There you go.
That's actually what it stands for.
Knight Rider Industries 2000. Oh, you could tell me what KIT stands for.
Yeah. God, I don't even... do you know what? I'm not even sure I've seen an entire episode, but somehow that was lodged in there. That's pathetic, isn't it? So, does that car get used?
No. Not as much as it could. I used to daily it, believe it or not, before fuel was 140 a litre. I used to daily that car, which was hilarious. And if any car was guaranteed to get you into a conversation at a petrol pump,
it was that one. Would be it. Did you always go in with the lights flashing?
with the lights flashing. And also, it doesn't have a front number plate. Well, it does, but it's tucked up underneath to make it look authentic. It's got a flashing red light on the front. It's got very heavily tinted windows. So it's committing. It's got a misspaced rear number plate. So the number plate is H10 NTV, which actually spells high on TV on the back. So it's committing about 10 motoring offences simultaneously whenever it drives. And yeah. I was driving through London in it about 10 years ago, and I got pulled over by a policeman and thought, well, you know, a fair deal. I am committing quite a lot of offences here. And he just wanted a picture.
Really?
It's like, I love Knight Rider. Can I do a picture? Hmm. And he wanted me to take a picture of him next to the car and then wave me on my way with my 10 motoring offences, which he wasn't interested in. It's
wow.
Great.
Good lad.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
You just before we came on, you did talk about a 911 that you've got, one that Andrew holds in the highest regard.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about your 997 Carrera GTS.
Well, like all sane people, before I make any car purchasing decision,
yeah, of course.
I do a
yeah.
search to see either of you two luminaries have ever written before purchasing. And I suggest that all listeners and viewers do the same thing, really.
Sure.
If you really want to get into the heart of the market, read a Prosser or Frankel piece and it will tell you what you need to know.
Yeah, you were kind enough to say that I'm the reason you have that car.
That's genuinely true, true. So I was looking at cars to buy and I wanted a 911. And I'd always thought the 997 to me, I love the 996 and the purists will give you many great reasons to buy a 996, of which I agree with all of them. I can never quite resolve myself to the styling of the 996, no. And particularly the interior.
Sorry, 996.
I think when the 997 came out, it just answered every single criticism.
Yeah.
And it's still quite a small car, isn't it? The
997 is, I'm sorry, it's just a better car. And particularly the Gen 2 cars, which didn't have the issues.
Yes, the issues.
Yes.
And I was reading a fabulous Andrew Frankel piece, which I'm sure they'll put in the show notes at the bottom, about the GTS and what a brilliant car it was.
Yeah.
And then I'd read that and thought, well, I'll keep my eyes out for a GTS. And then Ian Litchfield, another genius that we all know very, very
yeah,
well.
Yeah, indeed.
Have,
hello, Ian.
Have one for sale in his used car sales business from a collector that he looks after. And it was just the one, if you could have gone back in time and ordered the exact spec you want, so Riviera blue paint sample with painted tunnel, full carbon pack, diff, manual, two-wheel drive, sports wheel delete, just every single option that the purist and enthusiast would want. This gentleman had obviously ordered the ticket. Ian did me an incredibly fair deal, and Fast and Fun did the finance for me so I could afford it. And I don't think I'll ever sell that car. And everything you wrote about, Andrew, every reason to love that car, because GT3 would obviously be the choice that the real enthusiasts will go for. But like you say in your piece, it's probably a much more usable car every day. It's probably a much nicer thing to live with.
I remember when I first drove it. I think I must have been very new. Well, maybe even Twitter was very new. I think I just got on it when I went to America to drive it. And there was some mountain road. I got to the top of it. And I can remember sitting there and tweeting something on the lines of, this is all the car that anybody could ever want or need. And I don't really think I've materially changed that point of view. They are just... If we think of the 911 as being the ultimate sort of sports car daily driver, I think it is, you know, as good at that as any of the best sports car in the world has ever been.
Yeah, and obviously a GT3 is faster, but then you have to have the necessary talents to extract that performance, and I'm not necessarily sure that I have it.
Yeah, and it won't be as comfortable, and you won't have any rear seats, and, you know, we love GT3s, we absolutely do, but as a daily driver, would I have a GT3 or a GTS to probably have the GTS.
I think, and you think Marino Franchitti, a man who test drives singers for a living, that's his daily driver. And I thought, well, if it's good enough for him and you've recommended it, then when Ian offered it to me at a very sensible price, I could not resist.
Are there any other more glossy cars that we need to quickly mention?
There's a few. I think my favourite car, the one that I still can't believe that I own, I have a flat nose Porsche convertible, which I just so lucky. We were filming season one of Salvage Hunters Classic Cars, walked into a Jaguar import specialist down in Tewkesbury, funny enough, just around the corner from Ian Litchfield's, actually. And there are all the E-types that we are expecting to see. There's the Jaguar 340 that we ended up buying for the show. And then tucked in the corner is what looks like a factory converted flat nose Porsche convertible. So went up to it, and we're supposed to be filming the show, and the director keeps saying, stop looking at that Porsche, you hear film Jaguars. But, you know, if you see a flat nose, I just think they're one of the coolest things ever made. And I'm knocking on the wings and seeing all the bodywork, and it's all in steel. So I thought, well, that's got to be either a real one or using parts of a real one. Chatted to the lovely vendor, and he says, look, I don't know, I bought the car unprovenanced, so I've paid unprovenanced money for it. Mm. I've got a heritage certificate from Porsche, I've got some service history, but I don't know whether it's real or fake. So, you know, here's what I paid for it. Give me a drink on top, take it away. So I gave him his drink on top, as we do in the trade, took it away, and I paid for this car £29,000. And it's a California import, left-hand drive, rust-free, flat-nose convertible. Blimey. And with it was a pile of history. So I thought, well, let's see if I can find the story of this car. Went through all the bills, kept seeing this name. It was a Thai gentleman who lived in California in the 80s. So anyway, I'd see if I could find him on Facebook. Found him on Facebook, sent him a message saying, wow, I think I've got your car here in England. Lovely guy. Came back. Story was, he bought a 1982 SC convertible from Max Dial in California, narrow body, traditional headlights. Wanted to get a factory allocation for a flat nose. Couldn't get one. And then somehow managed to badger the race team, Alan Johnson Racing, who were Porsche's official race team in California, to fly all the parts out from Stuttgart and fit them to his car in the race team workshop.
That's fantastic.
So it's not an official one, but it was created out of official parts.
Yeah, as good as.
Yeah.
Good as.
So it's kind of the best kit car you could ever get. So it's all steel, all using the correct parts. The only difference he had, he used the RX-7 headlights rather than the 928 headlights because they're a lower profile and they're a bit cheaper and lighter to fit. But I mean, if you think the top of that mark, if you've got a right-hand drive turbo in immaculate condition, they're £250,000 now. I could never afford that car had it not been for the fact that it was an unprovenance left-hand drive. And it's based on a 3-litre SC, so obviously it's not turbo quick, but it's quick enough.
That's super cool. That is a mega that is, cool.
That is a good car.
Yeah, I love that.
So which of all the 82 cars, which is the one you would never sell? Which is your favourite?
That's a really good question. The one I can't ever sell. So my uncle, very kindly, he's still very much with us, so I hasten to add. My uncle bought a Panther Callista. Can you remember those, Andrew?
Yes, absolutely. Lemurs and Callistas.
No, explain to me, please.
So if in the 80s, if you wanted a traditional British roadster, obviously you went and bought a Morgan. And I can't think, was it 6 or 7 years, Andrew? There's a 6 or 7 year waiting list in the 80s for a Morgan.
Before Sir John Harvey Jones got hold of them.
Wow.
That's right, yeah, Troubleshooter. I remember that episode very, very well. So it left the market gap on a company called Panther, which was actually the brainchild of a guy called Robert Jankel, who's a great designer. And Jankel is still going as a defence constructor. So he started making pastiche cars. So his first car was a Jaguar lookalike called a J72. He then realised that there was much more of a mass market gap. So he created a car called the Lima, which was a fibreglass sort of pastiche roadster thing using Vauxhall mechanicals. And because he wanted to take the car up market and go toe-to-toe with Morgan, they did a hand-beaten aluminium body with Ford mechanicals, and the car was a little bit bigger. And that was called the Callista. My uncle, who really wanted a Morgan, couldn't be bothered to wait, went and bought this car brand new in 1989. And he's had it all this time. And he was a bit poorly a few years ago. And we did a bit like a car SOS. And while he was not very well, we went and nicked the car out of his garage.
And haven't given it back yet.
Well, I did. I did give it to him back. And when he was in remission from his cancer treatment, he was driving it for a little bit. But then because obviously cancer's not great on the body and it's quite a bone-shaking car, he wasn't driving it much anymore. And he was very kind and he let us have the car because he wanted us to have it while he was still alive so he could see us enjoy it. And that car, believe it or not, has only done 6,000 miles. And obviously because it's a family heirloom, it will now get passed down through generations of Cowlands. So that car, if they all have to go, that will be the one that's left.
Can I just say, the Panther Callista, I imagine most people listening to this, and particularly if you're going to see a picture of a Callista, you think, well, it's kind of nice and it's quaint. But actually, they weren't bad. They weren't to get in and drive about. They were certainly better than Morgan's to drive. I mean, they weren't a patch on. I mean, this is just, you know, before things like you know, front driver lands and MX-5s and all that sort of stuff started popping up and changing the reference points. But I can remember being favourably disposed towards the Calista. So there you go.
It's not bad, you know, because it's got the 2.8, which is the sweet engine. They did a 2.9 injection later, but this is a 2.8 on carbs.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's quite fronty, makes all the right noises. You're sitting on the back axle,
yeah,
like a poor-handling Caterham. And it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You've also mentioned before we came on the Ford Mustang that you've got. You've got a modern Ford Mustang. I don't know if the model's still within reach.
It is, to be fair. So I'll tell you this story. So I have never, 30 years in the motor trade, I have never ever, for obvious reasons, because motor trade people generally don't buy cars at retail because it's not good business, because they new cars lose money and motor trade people don't like losing money. It's not in our DNA.
Mm.
But I just always wanted to do something. I always wanted to go into a showroom once, just once in my life, put my money down like a muggle and buy a motor car. And I thought, I tried a few different cars and I test drove the Mustang, and you guys I know have both driven it. And I drove the 5-litre GT, and this is in 2019 I bought this car. And I just thought, what an incredibly characterful but wonderfully flawed car. I did a test drive of that car, and you'll probably have better tester notes than I will. You know, it's saggy, poor handling. Not great steering, awful torque delivery from the V8.
Yeah.
And I immediately in love with it, and as a tuner I just thought, you know, I can make this car better, I can do stuff to this car to make it better. So in 2019 walked into a Ford dealership, which my friend is the dealer principal of, and he did me an absolute sweetheart deal on a car, and I bought a lovely bright orange manual 5-litre GT, non-magna ride, rear spoiler, Recaros, because I do think as well, if you keep them long enough, if you look at other fast Fords like Capris, if you've got a nice Capri 280 with Recaros and all the right bits, I think those cars will always make their money. And I do think the last of the dinosaurs, the last manual Mustangs with Recaros, at some point
will
become a good one.
Agreed, yeah. So do you have that model in front of you?
I do. So that was the thing. So I've got the car, I've done all sorts of wonderful things to it, made it a lot nicer. And then a producer of ours on the show is a guy called John Lakin. John's a real polymath. He's all over the automotive world. But he also, as a part-time job, writes the box blurb for Corgi models. So Corgi cars, which we've all loved since we were kids. Corgi do a range called Vanguards, and all Corgi Vanguards are based on real cars. So each one has the registration number, the backstory, and is an exact replica of a real car. And he said, I've just come out of a product meeting. We're going to do a 5-litre GT Mustang as one of the cars this year. And he'd seen my car because I took it to set a few times. He says, can we do a copy of your car? Which is the most ridiculous question to ask any car enthusiast, isn't it? Would you like your car immortalized?
Yes, I would.
As a Corgi model? Stupid question. I said yes in about a fraction of a second. And this is the result. You can actually buy this. It's just come out. There you go.
Podcast listeners, you may need to go out to our YouTube channel to see what we're talking about. But it is an orange Mustang. It's not just an orange Mustang. It is your orange Mustang.
It is. And it's even got my registration number on. So if you're looking to do any kind of motoring offences in any thing, use that one.
Yeah, that's the one to clone. So I want to talk to you about this car because you have tuned it, you have modified it, and you are involved in that world. And this is an interesting discussion point generally, because why is it that some bloke in a lockup on some scruffy industrial estate somewhere is able to improve cars that have been developed by enormous teams of engineers with hundreds of millions spent on them by car manufacturers, you know, the biggest car manufacturers in the world? Why does the tuning world actually work?
Well, I think you're probably the best person to talk about this, because you bought one of the cars I think is closest to perfection from the showroom floor, which is the Alpine.
Yeah.
But then even people like David Pook who have made the Alpine even better.
Yeah.
Because I think any car manufacturer, whatever they're making in whichever market sector, unless it's somebody like a Pagani when the price doesn't matter, if you're anywhere in the middle or towards the bottom, you are always compromising to a price rather than to a quality. And I think everybody who's making any kind of mass-produced car always has to find that happy spot in the middle where the product team's happy, the accounting team's happy, the R&D and dynamics and chassis teams are happy. But everything on a modern car is a compromise, because it has to be, because it has to appeal to the widest number of people.
Yeah.
And it has to be designed down to a price.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the wonderful thing about the tuning world is you take all of those compromises away. So you say, oh, I don't care how much my bushes cost, I can fit polyurethane, or I can have a 3-way damper instead of a 2-way damper, or I can run a 330 mil disc instead of a 280 mil disc. And it's just the ability to take away the compromise that I'm sure the designer, had they been given free rein and unlimited budget, would have loved to have fit. And that's the magic. And that's why I've had so much fun with the Mustang. And I've done cars like the Subaru BRZ, so I was part of the accessories team for Subaru on the BRZ developing the products for that. And you could argue that the GT86, the Subaru BRZ, again, a car that's very, very close to perfection out of the box, certainly in terms of chassis dynamics, and with very few mods, becomes an incredible car. Really amazing. And that's, that to me, the journey of taking a car that's already very good and just making it better. Mm. That's the fun. Mm.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And car manufacturers also have to think about model hierarchies, don't they? So the Cayman can only be so good because it's, they don't want it to tread on the 911's toes too much, whereas you don't care. You know, you,
no, the owner, you think the tuner. How many years the Cayman didn't have a diff because they just couldn't have it being as good as the 911, correct, and they just had to keep it a little bit looser on the back. Otherwise, it would have murdered it, wouldn't it?
But what happens for people who aren't sort of au fait with the tuning world? What happens? Let's say you get your car comprehensively upgraded and you get a load more power out of it and the car becomes dramatically non-stable. What do people, and people will be worried about what happens to their warranties, they'll be worried about what happens to come MOT times. What are the sort of pitfalls and how do you get around it?
As with anything, like, it's all about balance, isn't it? So there's no point increasing the power if you haven't done the chassis, if you haven't done the brakes. And again, that's always the fun to me. You've got to create the equilibrium. So if you've gone up 20 horsepower, you know, we're going to need better dampers, we're going to need better bushes, we're going to need better brakes. So I think as long as you're doing everything in concert and not always do the safety items first, so always start with the brakes, start with the tyres, start with the, and then add power. I see people do it the other way around and that kind of blows my mind. Your warranty is going to go out the window, for sure, whatever. But again, if you're fitting quality parts and doing it properly with specialists that know what they're doing, for instance, Ian Litchfield, going back to him, he does a lot of amazing tuning work on Nissan GT-R.
Yes.
All of his warranted, and great tuners will do that if you're doing really high quality top
they'll warrant
work.
Their work
they'll warrant their work,
yeah, and so that's a good guide as to whether you're dealing with the right sort of people, presumably.
Yeah But I think you always accept that whatever you're doing, your factory warranty will go out the window. But again, so I spoke to the guys at Ford. I said, look, I'm going to do a few things to mine. I'm going to remap it, do a cat-back exhaust, I'm putting Bilstein coilovers on it instead of the factory dampers. And they were very good. To look, if you come in with a warranty claim, if a seat stitching has pulled, we're not going to put that down to the performance modifications. But obviously, if you blow your engine up, that's probably on you.
Yeah.
And I think you always, you know, we're all big boys, aren't we? We just, you pay your money and you take your choice and you run the small chance of things not working. But you think on any modern car, they're just going down to the lowest common denominator. When they're building those engines, they're thinking of the person that uses poor oil, poor fuel, doesn't let the car warm up, doesn't let the car cool down. And the engine is built to take those tolerances. But if you are the enthusiast that does use the best oil, does use the best fuel, does let it warm up, you can run much closer to the tolerance of the engine and the car without doing any damage.
Yeah. Mm.
I remember talking to Ian Litchfield about this, and he said, do you know, even if we've given you a load more power and your gearbox ultimately fails, it doesn't mean the gearbox has exploded to dust and there's no gearbox left. It probably means a cog has expired.
Yeah.
So we can replace that cog and away you go.
Yeah.
It's not the end of the world,
is it?
It's
just more fun, isn't it? And also, I don't want to be the guy that turns up anywhere in the car that's the same as the showroom model. I think you've got to... We're all car enthusiasts, aren't we? And I think you want to telegraph whichever car you're in that you are a car enthusiast. And I think people that know, and you know, and you look through a wheel and you'll see a better caliper or a bigger disc, or you look under the car and you see the hint of a carbon fibre tip or just little things. And I think, you know, doing what we all do... I think to kind of say to other car enthusiasts, you know, I like to just make a small change. I think it never hurts.
And are these changes? Well, I guess it depends on according to what sort of changes. But generally speaking, are you in danger of failing an MOT, putting your insurance premium through the roof? I mean, how does that work?
Well, you've always got to tune it. It's a very interesting time, actually. It's a good thing to talk about this. I don't know if you've seen the DVSA have recently launched an initiative called the Market Surveillance Unit. So using taxpayers' money, DVSA is now looking at the tuning industry, trying to find people that are doing unscrupulous things. And fair play to them. All they're trying to do is cut out the people that are doing things like DCATs, non-type reports cats, pop and bang remaps, which is, you know, one of the things that does my head in.
Yeah.
And I'm sure people's too. And all the kind of antisocial, naughty things, basically. The DVSA is clamping down on those. But the nice thing is there is an aftermarket federation called the PAAA, which is the Performance Automotive Aftermarket Association. That's the British SEMA. And what they're trying to do is create a quality standard, a bit like a Corgi gas fitter.
Yeah.
It says to the that if you want to fit an exhaust system, remap your car, fit a big brake kit, we will give you a quality standard that you can aspire to and you can check that says that everything is okay. Because if you do it properly, if you fit a sports cat that's type approved and EU marked and you fit a nice map that maybe has a gentle burble, doesn't pop and bang, these cars will fly through the MOT. And if you look at people like Ian, he is doing stuff to OE quality and beyond.
Yeah, absolutely.
And these cars are just as easy to get MOT. It's just not a drama. It's just about that happy middle ground where we're having fun with our cars.
Yeah. So much of it appears to be not so much what you're doing, but who's doing it, and just making sure that you don't cut corners and you go to the right people. Because otherwise, if you don't, you know, if you try to cut corners, save money, then you could actually end up in a bit of a world of pain.
You really can. And we're actually working with an amazing initiative at the moment called Vision Zero, which is the Devon and Cornwall Police. And they've got a road safety unit. And the whole Vision Zero thing is zero fatalities, because the sad thing is, in Devon and Cornwall, they've had deaths, either from people fitting performance parts incorrectly or poorly. So they've had things like spring failures, brake failures, and even an absolutely terrible story of a young lad that fitted his own sports exhaust with a decal and cut bonnet vents in his own car, and basically just sat in McDonald's car park texting and just died from carbon monoxide.
Oh, dear.
Unbelievable. So it just goes to show, like you say, Andrew, exactly that. You've just got to make sure that you're fitting quality things, and ideally with a quality person to do it.
Yeah.
And it makes all the difference in the world.
Cool. Mm. There is a lot of scope, isn't there, to improve even high-performance cars for all the reasons that you've mentioned. I've never really been involved in the tuning world. I've driven a lot of tuned cars and thought that many of them were significant improvements over standard, but I've never tuned any of mine. Andrew, have you?
Only slightly. I had this was before I was a journalist or anything. I had a Mark 1 1800 Golf GTI. And what did I do to it? I put some Bilstein dampers on it. I put some Yokohama HFR tyres, which was the first ever, I think just about the first ever sort of track suitable road legal tyre. And I put some ITEL tuned disc with some Tarox pads on it. So I did nothing to the engine at all. I just made it handle and stop. And actually, that car was transformed. It was so much nicer with the Bilsteins, because it didn't ride any worse. It just had so much more poise. It gripped, and anybody will know anything about, certainly right-hand drive Mark 1 1800 Golf GTIs will know that it did struggle to stop. And mine didn't.
Mm.
But it's what Paul was saying. Do the safety bits first. Yes. Do your chassis first, and then drive that, and then think, well, if you need some more power, then maybe address that. But I never felt the need to. I just love that car. The only other thing I've done is when I bought my 205 GTI.
We got it in. We got 205.
There you go. Yeah, exactly.
We should talk about that now.
It had been, someone had fiddled with it, but in a bad way. So it had the wrong manifold on it, had the wrong exhaust on it, it had some terrible dampers on it, had some awful wheels and tyres, and so I just retro-engineered it back to standard, and every single thing I did to that car made it better. Every backward step I took with that car improved it. So, you know, I think, Paul, I think what you say is so important to anybody thinking about modifying their car. You know, there's modifying your car and there's modifying your car. And if you go about it the right way, because of all the reasons we've talked about, because you can do things that manufacturers couldn't afford to do, then there are real gains to be made. And at the same time, if you don't do that, if you try to cut corners, try to save money, then you can ruin a lovely car.
Mm.
You really can. What's interesting at the moment as well is the DVSA is actually coming after tuners. So some of the less scrupulous tuners who are doing things like decats, they're actually mystery shopping them. So the DVSA bought a car, they bought the Fiesta ST, mystery shopped a tuner, who they actually got them to fit a decat pipe and a pop and bang map, and then took it to Myra to prove that they'd done naughty things, and then successfully prosecuted that tuner.
Gosh.
So I think the market is changing, because the law has always been the same law.
Yeah.
If the car's post-March 2001, you have to fit a type-approved EU-marked sports catalyst. That's never changed.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, what's happening is the government has decided to enforce it. So I think the market will change dramatically in the next 6 months. I really do.
Paul, we've run out of time. We've barely scratched the surface when it comes to your own cars.
Come back.
So we're going to have to do it again.
Yeah.
But interesting to hear about the tuning world as well. And there's clearly a lot going on in the tuning world. So maybe in 6 months, as you say, we need to catch up and see what's going on there.
We do. Why don't we do a reconvene, chaps? My place. We'll take a few cars out.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll do a live podcast of you driving Vipers and
fantastic.
GTSs.
Yeah, that's it. It's not raining.
Yeah.
We'll aim for summer. Not that that's any guarantee. But listen, Paul, thank you so much for coming on.
Really appreciate it.
Really good to talk. We will do it again. And to everyone watching, everyone listening, thank you so much for doing so. Just remember to follow this channel if you're watching on YouTube. If you're listening as a podcast, whichever app you're using, there'll be a little subscribe button or a follow button. Tap that. It really helps us. And we'll be back with another podcast next week.
Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.